This is a WSMI podcast from the Tally Broadcasting Station.
We'll start off this morning with a couple of national ag news items. $1.2 billion of milk exports from the U.S. to Mexico are at risk as Mexico appears to be seeking new trading partners. Mexico is America's top dairy exporter, and as the Donald Trump administration makes trade relations uneasy with its NAFTA counterparts, Mexico is in talks to import dairy products from New Zealand. In just the first 2 months of 2017, Mexico increased its imports of skim milk powder from the European Union by 122% over last year. Mexico has also been exploring talks with dairy powerhouse New Zealand. That country's trade minister visited Mexico in February to discuss a potential trade deal, according to Bloomberg News. University of Missouri ag economist Scott Brown says Mexico is looking to make sure they have market alternatives because of the rhetoric from the U.S. on renegotiating NAFTA. But co-bank economist Ben Lane says it's not just the NAFTA talk. He says demanding that Mexico pay for a border wall and taking a hard line on immigration likely have an impact as well. Cargill has announced it will exit from its U.S. cattle feeding business. The move means that in the last year, the company has gone from the fourth largest feeder in the U.S. to completely leaving the sector. Cargill has reached an agreement to sell its last two feed yards to Green Plains, Inc., which will purchase the feed yards for $36.7 million. Cargill's withdrawal from the feeding business highlights a change in priorities at the company, which says it's the world's largest supplier of ground beef, according to Reuters. Cargill is seeking to expand its North America-based protein business by exploring plant-based protein, fish and insects, along with other opportunities linked to livestock and poultry. The Green Plains Cattle Company, which is a subsidiary of the ethanol producer Green Plains, Inc., will supply cattle to Cargill for processing through a multi-year agreement, according to the companies. By buying the feed yards, Green Plains gains markets for its distillers' dried grains, an ethanol byproduct used to feed livestock. Well, looking at local news now, the local Pheasants Forever chapter recently distributed food plot seed to their members, and I had a chance to visit with the chapter's president, Glenn Bishop. You might not think that pheasants are very closely related to the typical farm news we talk about, but as it turns out, they're very dependent on farmers' CRP ground for habitat. This morning, we'll visit with Glenn Bishop about our local pheasant population and an activity the club offers each year.
This is our 20th anniversary. So I've been with the chapter from the beginning. I was the founding president. I believe the late Russell Hughes was the treasurer, and John Payden was the original vice president. And then Don Crancliffe came along and really helped out a lot to get the chapter started. And our main goal originally was to raise enough money to get a drill to put in the warm season grasses, which is the main part of the CRP program. And it took us really our first banquet, we had enough, and then co-oping with money through the DNR to buy that first Truax drill, which is still in use. We have two drills now, but we provide a good service for we rent those drills out for people when they are putting CRP habitat in the ground.
So what's the pheasant population like around here? Is it declining? Should we be worried about it? Or just fill us in on how it's going, I guess.
Well, you know, most people around here will tell you there is no pheasants. But, you know, if you have good habitat around a lot of areas, we do have good pheasants. I have a farm on the north end of Hillsborough Lake on the east side that I have a very good pheasant population. I've got a good quail population, too. The quail are probably in worse shape than the pheasants right now. But, you know, down toward Fillmore, there's a lot of pheasants. Over toward Nokomis, there is a lot of pheasants. And, you know, on the east side of Hillsborough Lake, I'm hoping my dad's property, we just got 100 acres of CRP put in there 2 years ago. You know, it's got a lot of wildlife to it, but not much pheasants. But there used to be back when I was young, so I'm hoping there's going to be a lot more there soon. Actually, there is a decent population, but it all comes down to the habitat on the ground to have, you know, the proper habitat for them.
So it sounds like CRP ground is necessary then. Do you ever release pheasants onto property like that to help the population?
I've seen a couple of times do that. You know, that is one thing that Pheasants Forever or Quail Forever, our sister company, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, does not allow chapter money to be spent on pen-raised birds because the research says it just does not work. So they would rather spend all the money on the habitat, you know, not all, but as much as they, you know, the chapters can do to help on the habitat, you know. But the CRP program is so vital, you know. Our chapter has upped our donation in the last couple of years to $3 for the Legislative Action Fund to help lobby for increased CRP acres because, you know, and as a prime example, you know, for me, I hunt and I hunt a lot, and probably 95% of the ground that I hunt is CRP ground. So that proves right there that, you know, if somebody wants to wild bird hunt, the CRP ground is very, very important for that.
So when I think of CRP ground, I also think of other predators of the birds, such as like coyotes and foxes. Is that an underlying issue with the population, or?
It is, but you know, I consider that a honor badge. You know that you know if you've got a lot of coyotes there, they're there for a reason because there is a lot of you know they're not stupid. They go where the game is and where their food is easier to get. So if you've got good habitat and good population of rabbits and quail and pheasants and deer and possums and raccoons and squirrels and everything, that's, you know, that's why the coyotes are there. And now the bobcats too. You know, there is a lot more bobcats than you think, you know, but it comes down to the fact of good habitat and good, you know, if there's nothing for them to eat, they're going to be moving on. So if you've got good habitat and good wildlife, you're going to have the good predators too, but probably the worst is the red-tailed hawk. I honestly believe the red-tailed hawk is probably one of the toughest predators on the upland game, just because I have seen it in action.
Well, that's interesting to think about. You know, you mentioned that you hunt a lot, and I know that's something that the chapter works with. You have kind of a training each year. Glenn, tell us a little bit about that and how someone could get involved.
We have what we call Wing Shooting 101, and that's based around Dennis McCamick at Cranny Mac. He has, you know, trained birds. He has pen-raised or trained dogs and pen-raised birds. And he will, you know, if you take a child there that has been through hunter safety and a hunting license, that we've changed from having just a youth hunt where we try to have, you know, 20 kids show up one afternoon, a bunch of volunteers, and we try to have, you know, put out pen-raised birds and get them shots. Scheduling and competing with particularly soccer, I mean, Sunday is not a open day anymore. It used to be, you know, that you could schedule something on Sunday afternoon, you could get a bunch of kids. Now, you know, all the other activities are taken up on Sundays too. So we went to this model where a parent or a mentor or grandparent or somebody could bring the child out, you know, sign up, bring the child out, and actually hunt alongside of them, you know, and the chapter will pay for, I think, four pheasants or two chuckers and four pheasants or something like that, and have an actual, you know, closer to a hunting experience that way, plus the parent, you know, gets to go along too. Because I know early on when we used to have youth hunt, when my daughter Ashley, you know, would go hunt, I wanted to be in the field with her at the time, and that's not how our youth hunts were set. It was the hunter and the guide in the field, you know. So now it's a hunter and being the child and the mentor being the parent or guardian or whoever is taking them out there and the guide, and they're having more of a true hunter experience than just a youth hunt. We've had a lot of success stories where a lot of actual families have turned into hunting families because of the Wing Shooting 101, where the child's out there, but the family enjoyed it also.
What time of year is that offered?
It's pretty much offered from, I believe, like September through March. It really depends on if Dennis has birds available to hunt and the weather is decent enough. You know, if it gets too hot, it's very tough on the dogs, and nobody wants to be out there in their hunting gear and stuff when it's too warm. That's the problem. So, you know, the heat, you know, colder is better in reality, but heat is not good.
And once again, that was Glenn Bishop, the president of our local Pheasants Forever chapter. And if you'd like more info about the group or the Wing Shooting 101 course, you can contact Glenn at 217-313-1069. And that does it for this morning's WSMI Farm Show. I'm Katie Wilson.